location of the 1990s. It started roughly in the year 2000 when former KGB operative Vladimir Putin entered the Kremlin. Stent explains that Putin mastered the sport of judo, which serves as an interesting metaphor for his modus operandi as Moscow's authoritarian leader. In judo, the seemingly weaker practitioner can rely on inner strength and force of will to defeat a larger, more aggressive foe. Accordingly, Angela Stent says that Putin has proven to be adept at seizing opportunities presented to him by the disarray in the West and the indecisiveness of some of its leaders. Putin's world, Stent says, is not just a product of deliberate Russian policies and tactics to reassert itself on the world stage. External factors are also at play. The fraying of the transatlantic alliance, as evidenced by democratic backsliding in Central Europe, waves of migrants landing on European shores that have led to a rise in populism, and even a questioning of the European project, have facilitated Russia's rise. And there is another important factor that has enabled Russia's ascendance, the election of Donald Trump and his pursuit of America First economic and foreign policy, which calls into question the durability of the NATO alliance and of the U.S. commitment to Europe. That's music to Vladimir Putin's ears. Putin's world examines Russia's deteriorating relationship with the United States, tensions with Europe and NATO, and Moscow's increasingly close ties to China. It also chronicles Russia's return to the Middle East in light of the vacuum left by the United States. The book illustrates how and why the post-Cold War era has given way to a more dangerous world in which Russia poses a challenge to the United States and around the world. Russia has also become a divisive subject in U.S. politics because of its interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. U.S. intelligence services confirm that Moscow-linked actors hacked Democratic campaign headquarters and launched a wide-ranging disinformation campaign on social media to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. Angela Stent is the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies and a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. She previously served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. She's also the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, about which we had the pleasure of interviewing her several years ago. Angela Stent returns to the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss her new book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. Angela Stent, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm delighted to be back on your program.
Welcome back, I should say. And I'm delighted to welcome Danila Galparovich. He's a reporter from VOA's Russian service.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, Angela, that was a long introduction, but I wanted to set the context. First, congratulations on the terrific book.
Thank you.
Basic question, why was the West, in your view, so wrong in thinking that post-Soviet Russia would move toward the West in terms of adopting a Western-style political and economic system?
So I think in some ways those of us who had studied this or people in the policy world maybe forgot what they knew about Russian history. When Mr. Gorbachev was in power and toward the end of the Soviet Union, he really did make overtures to the West. He had good relations with President Reagan and with other Western leaders. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed and then Boris Yeltsin came in and was surrounded by a small group of people also who wanted better relations with the West, who wanted to try something different, I think we thought that they would be able to do what they said they wanted to do. And I think we forgot the heavy weight of history, that Russia had never had a Western-style democratic system, and that for hundreds of years it had been ruled by czars and then communist leaders, and its view of the West was always really quite antagonistic.
Angela, that leads me to ask you a quick follow-up. How does Putin's Russia in particular use its history, geography, and culture to develop this compelling narrative, one that not only binds its diverse populations together, but also depicts the West as an enemy, as the title of your book suggests? You even talk about something like the Russian idea.
So Putin harkens back to centuries of Russian history and says Russia is a unique civilization. It's not like a European civilization. It's a unique Eurasian civilization. And it is in many ways superior to Western civilization. It focuses on the collective, not on the individual, on the close relations between the ruled and the ruler, if you like. And he talks about Russian exceptionalism. Now, the U.S. also talks about its own exceptionalism. But he appeals very much also to people who are Russian or speak Russian, who identify with Russia, who live in other parts of the world, the former Soviet space, but even beyond, and that they are also part of this unique culture. And he has pointed to Western civilization and Western Christianity as satanic because it believes in things like same-sex marriage and things like that. And he says that the Russian Orthodox Church is the true harbinger of real Christianity. And so he puts forward Russia as a leader of the conservative international.
Let me turn to my colleague Danila for a question.
Angela, yeah, your book is actually one of recent researches which suggests that Putin has this plan to undermine liberal democracies and to rebuild Russia's might, in other words. And he basically has an ideology, as you just explained. But this ideology was never set in stone, because I remember, for example, his visit in the year of his first presidency in Germany, when in Bundestag, he was in the German parliament, he was speaking German, and terms democracy, freedom, and friendship with the West were all over this text. So don't you think that actually we have a tendency to inflate him as conservative ideological leader while he's trying to only scare his own population to stay in power? Because there were times when he was without any ideology or even friend with Tony Blair and even Bill Clinton, if we remember his first G8 in 2000.
Yes. So when he first came to power, Putin looked as if he did want closer ties to the West. You're quite right. He had a visit to Germany where he sounded very conciliatory. He talked about democracy. He was reaching out to the West. And so he didn't come in with this particular ideology. And anyway, beforehand, he was a communist, allegedly. Anyway, he was a KGB agent. So what happened? I think if you ask Putin that, he would say, I did want closer relations with the West. And after 9/11, I was the first leader to call George Bush. Russia helped the United States in the initial phase of the war in Afghanistan. We wouldn't have been able probably to do what we did in the fall of 2001 without Russian assistance. But the problem was that Putin's expectations from what would come from this new partnership with the United States were very different from U.S. expectations, and he feels that they were betrayed. So he thought that the United States would treat Russia. He wanted an equal partnership of unequals. He wanted to be treated as an equal. What Putin, I think, would say is what he got was the United States pulling out of a significant arms control treaty even in December 2001, the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Then we got the Iraq war, where Russia wasn't consulted, and the regime change that the United States effected in the Middle East caused great instability and also made Putin wonder about which other countries would be targets of U.S. regime change. And I can go on with the litany, the enlargement of NATO and the European Union to the Baltic states. So I think the answer to that is he has developed this ideology over time. I'm not sure whether he believes in it, but it's certainly what he tells his people and how he portrays Russia abroad, and so that's important.
I'd like to now go forward to 2014. This is how you start your book. You actually juxtapose Moscow's hosting of the 2014 Olympics with its then subsequent invasion of Crimea, which of course belongs to Ukraine. Talk about 2014 as somewhat of a watershed in Russia's relations with the West.
I think it was clearly the watershed since Putin's been in power since 2000. Yes, Russia had won the right to host the Winter Olympics. He didn't have any top Western leaders there because there were already great concerns about what Russia was doing domestically. But they certainly put on a very good show. They had lots of foreign guests there. But while that was going on, what was happening in Ukraine was that the then leader, Mr. Yanukovych, was extremely unpopular. There had been protesters in the streets for months. And things came to a head where 100 people were killed in Kiev while all this was going on. And once the Olympics were over, the Ukrainian leader, after signing an agreement, fled. And so there was a new government that was coming to power in Ukraine. And that was when the Kremlin decided it was time to seize Crimea because they didn't know what was going to happen after that. And so, of course, they sent these so-called little green men into Crimea, that is to say, not wearing Russian military uniforms. And they seized Crimea. They annexed it. And then from there, they launched a war in southeastern Ukraine. And of course, that's been going on since then for the past 5 years.
And indeed, the West, the United States, Europe imposed sanctions. They're still in place. Of course, there was the crash of that Malaysian airliner that the West pretty much attributes to Russians, the so-called little green men or whoever were in eastern Ukraine. which they don't acknowledge. So we're not in a full-fledged Cold War. We don't have that ideological competition, as you say, as we did in that era. But we're in a sort of Cold War 2.0.
Yes, I think we definitely are. I mean, it feels like a Cold War. Now, in contrast to the Cold War, the United States is militarily much stronger than Russia. Russia is partially integrated into the global economy, which it wasn't, of course, during the Cold War. There is no global ideological competition. So the ideology that Putin talks about is not supposed to have a universal appeal like communism did. But although I would say there are ideological differences, but essentially Putin has portrayed the West and the United States as the enemy for some time, as the cause of Russia's economic difficulties because of the sanctions, without ever explaining that sanctions are imposed in response to what Russia did, but the Russian population never told that. And so there's that enemy image. And then you have, of course, a lot of that in the United States. I would say the other unique element of it right now, from the U.S. point of view, is that Russia has become a toxic domestic issue in the United States in a way that actually the Soviet Union never was during the Cold War, except maybe during the 1950s and the McCarthy era. As we know, I mean, it's part of a very bitter domestic partisan divide in this country, which, again, we haven't seen for decades. So there are elements that feel like the Cold War, but it's not completely like the Cold War.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Angela Stent. She's the author of the new book about Russia, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Danila Galperovich. He's a reporter in VOA's Russian service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also access it on iTunes. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Accra, Ghana, Henry Ose Kuranchi. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now a question from Danila.
Thank you very much. What I want to ask you, Europe for a long time and now some people in the U.S. telling about double-track approach to Russia, and you're actually writing about it in your book, to engage when possible, to deter when necessary, but it doesn't work, does it? I mean, when they've been proposed to have talks about arms control, of course they will say, leave us alone with our human rights or with Ukraine, and we can talk with you about these missiles.
I mean, I think that from the European perspective, you cannot give up the track of talking to the Russians. And by the way, I mean, the U.S. shouldn't do that either, just because they're neighbors and they have to interact with Russia. Now, it's very difficult, and obviously the relationship of many European countries with Russia today, particularly Germany, which was always Russia's major partner, are difficult. The relationship with Britain is, of course, atrocious because of the poisoning of the Skripals and the death of someone else in England as a result of the way they disposed the poison. Anyway, I'm sure that they would argue now that so far it hasn't worked well. The European Union had this partnership for modernization with Russia, which they've kind of given up, because that's, again, the idea that if you engage Russia economically and you try and find other ways to engage, then that will, particularly the trade, will moderate the political behavior, and it hasn't worked like that. But I think the problem, the issue today in Europe also, is Europe is quite divided over Russia. Countries like Hungary have now become much closer to Russia again. And so there's no consensus in Europe about how you deal with Russia, except that you do have a sanctions regime that they keep in.
Well, let me ask you all about this NATO enlargement to which you alluded earlier. In hindsight, do you agree with some analysts who believe that the U.S. drive to quickly expand and enlarge NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union, given the admission of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, and then moving further east, was perhaps an error of American post-Cold War policy?
I don't think it was an error. And this is a very controversial subject, and there's a lot of revisionism about it. Mr. Gorbachev himself has said on several occasions nobody promised him that NATO wouldn't enlarge. And you know, the U.S. and the West Europeans were faced with a choice when the Soviet Union collapsed. The countries in Central Europe felt very insecure. They'd been dominated by Russia and then the Soviet Union for centuries, and they wanted to join NATO. They really did. They wanted protection against being invaded again. Russia didn't like the idea of NATO enlargement, although Yeltsin didn't really complain in the beginning. And even Putin, when he first came in, didn't say very much about it. And it became impossible for the U.S. to satisfy both what the Central Europeans needed and what Russia wanted. And so in the end, it focused on the Central European countries. Now, you can go back and say, well, if we wouldn't have done that, then maybe the relationship with Russia would have been much better. I'm not convinced of that.
And Angela, you talk about the disarray in the West as facilitating Putin's rise. So I have a quick question. How much does Russia's rise have to do with both Obama and then Trump's foreign policies? To what extent has the U.S. left a vacuum in Syria and elsewhere for Moscow to fill?
I think it certainly has. I mean, Putin had a plan in as much as he wanted to restore Russia as a great power. I think he couldn't have dreamt of the opportunities that were given him. First of all, when the war began in southeastern Ukraine, President Obama gave an interview to the Atlantic Monthly where he explicitly said, we understand that Ukraine is an existential question for Russia. It isn't for us, and we're not going to respond militarily. It's the prudent answer, but it just reinforces the fact that Putin understood that the U.S. wasn't going to. So, you know, we imposed sanctions. As you said, there was a red line in Syria, and there wasn't. And I think that's what facilitated Putin coming in September of 2015 and starting an air bombing campaign backing Bashar al-Assad, who at that point looked as if he might be defeated. That was certainly an opportunity for him. And I think under President Trump, it's not only the withdrawal from Syria, which Putin is quite happy about, but it's the fact that President Trump denigrates the NATO alliance. Since the dawn of NATO, the Soviet Union and then Russia have always said NATO is an enemy, we don't need NATO, and now they have an American president who's essentially saying things that they wouldn't quite say so explicitly. And it was quite clear at this year's Munich Security Conference that the European allies, particularly the Germans, they feel caught now between, if you like, Trump and Putin, Russia and America, and they don't quite know where to turn.
Danila.
What do you think? How successful was Kremlin, Putin, to divide American society with their hacking stories, with their troll stories, with all this involvement in U.S. politics?
So the divisions were there already. And I think what the Kremlin, what the people in the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg exploited were divisions that were there, and they exacerbated them. They very cleverly understood how to pit different ethnic groups against each other, different political groups against each other, and they're still doing it. They're still trolling, they're still trying to do this, and they're not going to give up because they like to disrupt. So I think you can't blame them for the polarization in the society, but you can say that they helped exacerbate it.
And we are seeing that today, and we see even a divide within the U.S. administration where you have, thanks to Congress, we have some of the strongest sanctions against Russia, but the rhetoric by the Trump administration on Russia and Putin, particularly from Mr. Trump, doesn't line up with that. Do you think these contradictory signals serve to encourage Putin's adventurism?
Well, I think the Russians are very perplexed now because I think what they underestimated was the domestic impact of what they did in 2016. So they must be having buyer's remorse because you now have a president who would have wanted a much more forward-looking policy toward Russia. He wanted to lift the sanctions when he came in. He was apparently prepared to think about recognizing Crimea as part of Russia. He has been unable to do that because of what the Russians did domestically and because of all of these domestic constraints. And therefore, you have obviously a multifaceted policy toward Russia. You have a president who still will never criticize Putin. By the way, Putin has never criticized President Trump either, even though he criticizes the United States. Then you have a Congress that's very tough, that imposes sanctions practically every week. And you have an executive branch that pursues a pretty hard-nosed policy toward Russia, including doing something the Obama administration wouldn't do, which is sending defensive lethal weapons to Ukraine and helping the Ukrainian military more. So I think the Russians haven't gotten quite what they wanted. I think they view President Trump now as being more unpredictable maybe than they realized, but I think maybe they still have some hope that he'll be able to prevail.
Angela, my question is now about Putin himself. You ending your book with the question of succession as something which really matters for Russia now, for Putin. So what do you think, how scenario will develop? I mean, we see now things in Kazakhstan, we see now things in Belarus, where leader is also old and almost, you know, from Soviet age. So what do you think?
2024.
So in 2024, Putin is constitutionally obligated to step down. So there are a number of Russians I know who think that Putin will never step down, that he's going to stay in the Kremlin until the end. And then there are others who think that he will try a managed transition, sort of like when he took over from Yeltsin. I think that will be very hard to do, and if he does it too early, he's a lame duck, i.e. to pick a successor. And then you have to pick a successor who not only guarantees your personal liberty and that you can keep your assets, but that all your family can do it, and then your other groups of people around you. So with President Nazarbayev's resignation, and knowing that he now is the head of a National Security Council where he can still exercise power, other people think that what President Putin might do is either use an existing organization like the State Council in Russia or create some other body where he would be head of that body. Someone else would sit in the Kremlin as president, but where Putin would still exercise influence, or it's like the Deng Xiaoping model. Or, as you mentioned, Belarus and Russia already have on paper a union that you would create this Belarusian-Russian state, and that Mr. Putin would be the president of that, and then someone else would be the president in Russia. There's no precedent in Russian history for something like that. So I remain skeptical about that last one, but I know a lot of people are looking at it and saying this could be what happens.
So till 2024, it's still 5 years, and 5 years of U.S.-Russian tensions, relations, negotiations. What do you expect in that?
I don't expect U.S.-Russian relations to improve measurably over the next 5 years. If the Mueller report doesn't prove collusion, then it might be somewhat easier to re-engage Russia on some issues for President Trump. But since in 2020 we'll immediately begin an election campaign, we'll have all the same constraints as we have now. You know, if President Trump gets a second term, it might be possible to do more with Russia, again, depending on what's happening domestically. If it's a Democrat, then I think they would at least start off by being very tough. Who knows what would happen after that. But the fundamentals are just not good, because the enemy image of the West is very important in Russia, and there aren't that many issues that we really necessitate us to talk to each other. Arms control is one of them, and that's a very serious one. And the other one is, you know, we keep imposing sanctions on Russia, but at some point they become counterproductive. So I'm not sure. I think I would say I'm not sure what the agenda is for U.S.-Russian relations moving forward, except maybe, you know, pulling them back from what appears to be the brink of something that could be dangerous.
I'd like to ask you, Angela, how much of where Russia stands today since 2000, when Vladimir Putin came into power, is due to his KGB background, his heavy-handed security apparatus, his strict control over all levers of the state, the industry, media, in addition to those historical factors to which you alluded earlier?
This is a highly personalistic system. Institutions exist on paper, but they don't mean very much. So everything in today's Russia is based on connections and who you know. And so if you look at the formal institutions, they don't mean very much. And I think that really is unique to Putin, and it's enabled him to move forward and, you know, impose a much more repressive regime. They're now trying to control the internet. So the question is, and this gets back to the previous question, if he's no longer leading Russia, then how does this personalistic regime continue without the institutions? And would it continue like this? And I think the answer to that is it will change. But he's managed to do it by really eviscerating what institutions there were, and there weren't that many under Yeltsin either.
Where does the democracy movement stand at this point?
Well, there are still groups of people in Russia who are democratic activists. Unfortunately, historically and today, many of them are divided. They're a small group, but they can't even agree on a leader. Alexei Navalny is the leader that we know most. He's a big anti-corruption leader. Is he a democratic leader? That I'm not sure about, but he certainly is concerned about corruption. Many of the democracy activists have left Russia. So unfortunately, it's a rather small movement. And I think it's also a testimony to the fact that, you know, both European and U.S. policies to support democracy groups in Russia haven't been very successful.
In terms of where do we go from here, you know, toward the end of the book, you talk about seven pillars of Putin's world. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to just summarize that for us. And where do we go from here? I mean, in terms of the balance of power.
Right. So the maxims obviously are that, you know, Russia has a right to the seat at the table on every important international decision. And what Putin is trying to get is for the rest of the world, including and foremost the West, to recognize that even though we don't define our interests the same as Russia, we should recognize they are as legitimate as ours. And that means we should recognize that Russia has a sphere of influence, is entitled to a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space, and that countries like Ukraine and Georgia should never join NATO and the European Union, not that either of those things are on offer at the moment, and also that we should buy into the Russian notion that a few countries in the world are fully sovereign, like Russia and China and India, and that countries that have alliances aren't truly sovereign, and that smaller countries have limited sovereignty. And that's certainly a pillar of what Putin believes. And then I think another very important element is that Russia and China together say that the world order that the United States led after the collapse of the Soviet Union is over, that it didn't take into account the interests of Russia and China, and that we need, you know, a post-West system. The Russian foreign minister has used that phrase, whatever that means.
Well, speaking of China, talk about, briefly, before we close, the dangers posed by rapprochement between China and Russia. Are you seeing more and more this type of rapprochement?
So the Russian-Chinese rapprochement, I would say, has been one of the great successes for Putin. It's not that there aren't problems in the relationship, their tensions, and it's an unequal relationship. The Chinese, if you like, are the big brother and the Russians are the junior partner. But China has backed Russia up since the West tried to isolate Russia after Ukraine. Economically, it works with Russia. And again, both China and Russia are allergic to U.S. attempts to sort of promote democracy and to impose the kind of rules-based order that the U.S. and its allies believe in. So, and I would also say that the policies of the Trump administration, that is to say, sanctions on Russia and a trade war with China, are also pushing Russia and China closer together. So as they work closer together and as they now have joint military maneuvers, I think we have to take this very seriously and think in a little bit longer term about what we can do about that.
They do pose a true threat to democracy, as we're seeing around the world, and the rise of populism as well. But let me turn now to Danila for a last question.
Speaking about China, Xi Jinping, as Putin, wants to rule forever, as we now know. How Putinism is attractive for other countries? We see some things of this in Hungary, some things of this in Italy. Even somebody is mentioning United States. Speaking of Putinism, what do you think this system brought to the world?
So I suppose it's a strong leader who promises stability to his people. I mean, that's another thing Putin says, you know, I bring you stability. I mean, the first 8 years he was in power, he did bring prosperity to them, but that's because oil prices were rising, and so the Russian economy did fantastically well. But as long as oil prices are more or less stable at the rate they are now, there's a level of economic stability there, even though the sanctions have adversely affected Russia. I suppose it's a sense of order. I suppose in Putin's case, it's a sense of pride in the country, you know, appealing to patriotism, nationalism, and the enemy image of the West. You know, he's protecting his population against the West. And so those are the elements. And for would-be strongmen leaders who would like to control the press, who want to control the judiciary, Putin's an attractive model.
That is not a very optimistic way to end, but the book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, the author, Angela Stent. Angela, thank you for coming in, sharing your fabulous insights. Congratulations again on the book.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Joining me on the program was VOA Russian service reporter Danila Galperovich. And thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm David Berg. The UN Security Council met privately Friday to discuss the recent escalation of tension between India and Pakistan following India's August 5th decision to revoke the special status of Jammu and Kashmir. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
After appeals from Pakistan, permanent council member China requested the meeting. Beijing's new UN envoy, Zhang Jun, said afterwards that India's decision has changed the status quo in Kashmir and caused tensions in the region.
China is deeply concerned about the current situation and opposes any unilateral action that complicates the situation.
Kashmir has been a regional flashpoint for decades. Nuclear powers India and Pakistan have fought several wars over the disputed territory.